Hello there, and welcome to The Bitch Fix, a podcast for women who want to jam out on their lives, live in harmony with their hormones, and reclaim their mood, energy, and mojo. I'm Christine McCarroll, functional nutritionist and women's health straight talker, and I'm here to tell it like it is on all things health, happiness, and hormones for women. So shake off that cape, Superwoman, because we're here to launch this thing.
Well, hey girl, and welcome to episode 152 of The Bitch Fix. So on the podcast this week, I had the privilege of interviewing Dr. Anna Lemke, the New York Times bestselling author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Dr. Lemke has also written about the opioid drug crisis in her book, Drug Dealer MD, and has appeared as an expert in the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. So on this episode, Dr. Lemke and I discussed how our brains are wired for the pursuit of pleasure, how this wiring can get us hijacked in a modern era of abundance, and how everything from romance novels to heroin can be fodder for addictive behavior, even if we don't necessarily think of ourselves as, quote, addicts. So this interview is the last in this month's series relating to ADHD in honor of ADHD Awareness Month. And while Dr. Lemke and I didn't specifically get into ADHD, dopamine, the neurotransmitter that we are discussing in this episode, happens to be the primary neurotransmitter that is also involved in the symptoms of ADHD. And Dr. Lemke also discusses the use of stimulants like Adderall and also the abuse of those in her book. So that said, this episode is literally for everyone. Per her formal bio, Anna Lemke is professor of psychiatry at Stanford University of Medicine and chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. As clinician scholar, she has published more than 100 peer-reviewed papers, book chapters, and commentaries. She sits on the board of several state and national addiction-focused organizations, has testified before various committees in the United States House of Representatives and Senate, and keeps an active speaking calendar and maintains a thriving clinical practice. Now we welcome Dr. Anna Lemke. Dr. Anna Lemke, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm just thrilled to have you joining me. I have actually read your book twice, so we're going to be talking about your book, Dopamine Nation. You've written more than one, but that's the one that that inspired me to reach out. And I was rereading it last week, kind of in preparation for this conversation, and I was highlighting it. And my daughter, who's 15, is like, she's just learning about highlighting books in high school right now.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, mom, is this like, what do you highlight? And I said, well, I'm highlighting the things that are important. And she's like, well, what if everything is important?
That's
I was like,
very cute.
Yeah, but actually that was my feeling in this book is like, everything is important. So it was hard to highlight.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you.
So I am definitely going to, you know, beyond the topics we talk about today, I'm going to recommend that everyone reads the book.
Well, thank you.
So this is a really timely conversation, obviously. I know that people have a question already just starting out, like, what is dopamine? We're going to talk about dopamine. I have a lot of kind of secondary questions to that. But just starting out, the whole title of the book is Finding Balance. Dopamine is a kind of neurotransmitter that isn't necessarily about balance. So can you just tell us what is dopamine and what does it maybe drive us to do, or how does it drive us to act?
Yeah. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter in the human brain. Neurotransmitters are molecules that bridge the gap between neurons. That gap is called the synapse. And those neurotransmitters allow for fine-tuning of the electrical circuits conducted by the neurons. So they're like little modulation molecules. Dopamine has different functions in the brain, but one of its most important functions is for the experience of pleasure, reward, and motivation. And it may be even more important for motivation than for pure pleasure. For example, there was a very famous experiment where rats were engineered to have no dopamine receptors in their reward circuit in their brain. And what the scientists discovered is if they put food in the rat's mouth, the rat would eat the food and seem to get pleasure from eating the food. But if you put the food even a body length away, the rat would starve to death. In other words, the absence of dopamine took away that organism's motivation to do the work to get the reward. So dopamine, you know, it's important for pleasure, but again, it's very, very important for motivation. The more dopamine that's released in the reward pathway and the faster it's released, and this is really important, the faster it's released, the more likely it is to be addictive. And also dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's not just released in response to pleasurable stimuli. It's also released in response to anything that nature feels like we need to pay attention to. So it can be released in response to aversive stimuli as well, or even just anything that's novel in the environment, anything that's new. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that says, pay attention to this.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So that's really easy to visualize. I'm like imagining it like a bright red flashing light of like, here is where attention belongs. And I can imagine that millions of years ago, when we were beginning to be evolving on this planet, we had to pay attention to where to get food. We had to pay attention to how not to get eaten by the lion. We had to remember where there was water. There were probably, even though there was a whole world full of signals of this is important, they probably fell more easily into specific categories, I'm going to guess. Go ahead.
Well, the big difference between the Earth as it was for most of human existence and the Earth as it has been for the last 200 years is that for most of human existence, we lived in a world of profound scarcity and ever-present danger. Like we had to work 24/7 just to live to age 30. Mm-hmm. Most of us died in infancy. We no longer live in that world. We now live in this world of overwhelming abundance, where for most people living, especially in wealthy nations, all of our basic survival needs have been met. And further than that, we have now basically surrounded ourselves with these highly accessible, highly abundant, highly potent, novel drugs. We've even drugified things that used to be healthy or good for you. And we have drugs that didn't exist before, like social media and video games and online pornography and online shopping. Mm-hmm. So the result is that, you know, our ancient wiring, which was evolved for this world of scarcity, is really mismatched for the world that we live in today, which is why we're seeing growing rates of compulsive overconsumption, addiction, and the sequelae of that, which is despair, essentially anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria.
Yeah. So I want to unpack that a little bit. Have our brains actually changed all that much since millions of years ago, or are they essentially functioning the same way that they did?
So it depends on what part of the brain you're talking about. But if you're talking about the reward circuit, that has remained largely unchanged across species and over millions of years of evolution. We are reflexively wired to approach pleasure and avoid pain. It's what has kept us alive in a very dangerous world. We don't have to think about it. We do it reflexively. In fact, where we do have, you know, a heavy cognitive lift is to actually avoid pleasure and approach pain. That is hard. And that requires the massive, you know, gray matter frontal lobe that we have added on top of the more primitive structures of our brain over, you know, the last periods of evolution. But that reward circuit is essentially identical in a lizard, which is why it's sometimes referred to as lizard brain.
Yeah. So we have the same structures, but we have, I mean, I don't know if you know a number, but like an amplitude of millions times more sorts of stimuli now than we did before. What does that do to our interaction with our world when we have that constant availability? Like just as humans, not even addicted humans, just like as a human.
Right. Well, what it means is that we're all more vulnerable to the pathophysiology of addiction, and we're all engaged in compulsive overconsumption, even if we're not crossing that threshold into addiction. And the reason for that is highlighted by the neuroscientific findings in the last 50 to 75 years, showing that pleasure and pain are co-located in the brain. So the same parts of the brain that process pleasure also process pain. and they work like opposite sides of a balance. When we experience pleasure, it tips one way. When we experience pain, it tips the other. But there's an overarching rule governing this balance, and that rule is that the balance wants to remain level. Mm-hmm. And with any deviation from neutrality, our brains are going to work really hard to restore a level balance. And they do that by tilting an equal and opposite amount to whatever the initial stimulus was. So if the initial stimulus was pleasurable, we're going to pay for that with a period of pain equal in measure right afterwards. If the initial stimulus was painful, we're going to get a little, you know, bounce into happiness following on the heels of pain. And that's really, really relevant for understanding how our brains are responding to this reward overloaded world. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what happens is when we are exposing our brains to a reinforcing substance or behavior, and they're surrounding us all day long from the moment we grab our phones, you know, in the morning and see who texted us, to our morning cup of joe, all the way to our Netflix shows in the evening, we're getting a surge of dopamine from those stimuli, not just a little bit, a whole lot. It's coming out really quickly. And our brain responds by tipping an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. I like to imagine that as these neuroadaptation gremlins hopping on the pain side of the balance to bring it level again, but they really like it on the balance, so they stay on until we're tilted an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. That's the come down, the hangover, the after effect, or just that moment of wanting to, you know, eat one more sugary muffin or watch one more Netflix episode. Now, if we wait long enough, those gremlins hop off and, you know, that craving passes and homeostasis is restored. But the urge to continue to consume once our pleasure pain balance is tilted to the side of pain is really overwhelming, because we want to get it back to homeostasis, or better yet, back to the side of pleasure. And so if we have immediate access to our next show, and of course with Netflix, we don't even have to press a button, right?
It just comes on.
It just comes. Like, we have to stop it, right? We have to do work to stop it. And that's so emblematic of the world that we live in today. We actually have to do work to not get our reward, which we are not evolved for. But the result of that, if we continue to expose our brain days, weeks, months to continued pleasures, what happens is that an initial deviation to pleasure gets weaker and shorter. That's called tolerance. Yeah. But here's a really key piece: that after response to pain gets stronger and longer. In other words, those gremlins start to multiply. Pretty soon we have enough gremlins on the pain side of the balance to fill this whole room. And eventually they're camped out there, tents and barbecues in tow. And that's the addicted brain, right? Then we're in it, what we call a chronic dopamine deficit state. Now we need to use, not to get high, but just to level the balance. And when we're not using, we're walking around with a pleasure pain balance chronically tilted to the side of pain, experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance or behavior, which are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, depression, and craving.
Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about pain, like, most people associate that with, like, I have a physical pain, and in a way it is a physical pain. Like, that craving can be a physical thing.
Absolutely.
And you're not like, okay, pain, like all of a sudden my toe hurts. It's like, it's the pain I'm almost imagining, like heartbreak or loss. Like, it's the emotional discomfort, and it's the space that you want to fill with the pleasure, right?
Yeah,
so there is the thing that's like, I need that thing back in that space. There's an empty hole there that I don't like. Is that right?
Yeah. So when I use the word pain in this context, I'm really talking about both physical and psychological pain. There are many drugs and I think withdrawal from all drugs is psychological. So it's like you said, it's a hunger, it's a yearning, it's a wanting to fill that space. But there are also many drugs that have a physical component to their withdrawal,
right,
and some drugs that have a life-threatening physical component, right? For some people, alcohol, benzo, and opioid withdrawal can actually be life-threatening. People can seize and die. It's the, you know, minority of people who are at risk of that, but that's a possibility as well.
So I think one of the things you did really well in the book was having these case studies that spanned the spectrum. So somebody on, like, the very extreme, where someone's like, that is someplace I would never go, or I wouldn't understand that kind of addiction, to something that may seem a little bit more mundane. You shared about your personal journey with romance novels,
right?
Which is fascinating, because I have spoken to someone recently who is experiencing that exact same thing.
Yeah, right.
I can recognize that.
Right.
But in a way, it's like, you know, we all have our personal we all have our personal pleasure seeking thing that we're doing. So we all have the capacity in a world where everything is available all the time to get those constant hits. And, and probably we're trying harder and harder to shrink the space between the feeling of, oh gosh, that thing is gone and I have to get the next hit of that thing.
Right. I mean, that's precisely the problem now, that we do have nearly infinite access at the touch of a finger to these, you know, feel good pleasures, you know, or at least these escapes. And it does make us all more vulnerable to the problem of addiction because we've sort of hacked the motivation circuits, whether it's a romance novel or, you know, a cannabis gummy or a cup of coffee. You know, we have figured out as a species how to make it its most potent form. We've also figured out that when we start to run out of its effects, if we combine two drugs together, you know, it'll... it's more potent. We've figured out these ways to, you know, get more potency. So that's why you'll see, for example, people, what they call double screening now. They're watching Netflix and on their phones at the same time.
Like everybody.
Like everybody are on their phones and smoking at the same, you know.
Yeah.
It's like we're all, our threshold continues to go up for what we need to experience pleasure. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, our sensitivity to pain is going up because that pleasure pain balance gets more and more tilted to the side of pain. So it's really problematic because I think what a lot of us are experiencing is that essentially that our relentless pursuit of pleasure leads to pain.
Right.
You know, it puts us in this not, you know, not just in a neutral state when we're not using, now we're in a painful state when we don't have our drug. Which is why, you know, the understanding this is crucial because the intervention is going to be very, very different given the reality of that neuroscience. The intervention is going to be not, well, make yourself more comfortable or, you know, go to a therapist and you know, to find somebody who sort of absolves you of, you know, responsibility or curl up in a fetal position with a really soft blanket. Instead, it's going to be, well, you know, our problem is that we have too much comfort.
Yeah.
And too many intoxicants, and that what we really need to do is make our lives intentionally harder.
Which is what we are hardwired not to do.
That's right.
See, exactly. So at the beginning of the conversation,
yes.
We're hardwired to avoid it.
Yeah.
So even doing the thing like pressing pause on the next Netflix show that wants to pop up is in a way we're triggering that little bit of pain because we actually had to stop the pleasure from coming in. But we've also reset our baseline. So, and I wanted to be actually like explicit on some of the things that you're calling drugs in your book is it's not just drugs the way that we typically thinking of them. And even though lots of people are familiar now with like the opioid crisis, certainly there is a actual drug component. There are things that people have long recognized as drugs like alcohol, even though they are legal. But then there are also things like I would say 90% of everybody I know has to have a morning cup of coffee, right? Mm-hmm. There's social media. There's even like the games on our phones. Mm-hmm. There's constant dinging from the work email coming through, which some people actually, I think, respond, you know, almost a Pavlovian response to the ding of the email or the text or whatever coming through. Mm-hmm. So there is no world in which we exist unless we just go out and live in like, you know, the tundras of Alaska or something where there isn't something coming in because we all have something. And then that baseline is just constantly getting shifted. Something that I thought was an interesting concept is that we then have to get more of that thing to remain neutral.
Right.
So that the baseline is now adjusted to that stimulus. And I was immediately just thinking of coffee again, because that's like everyone I know. So, and people say it in a joking way, like I have to have my cup of coffee to be human in the morning. Mm-hmm. Like everybody says that, but like truly now we have a different baseline because we're caffeinated.
Yep. That's right. Yeah. And I think, you know, if it were just coffee, you know, which is, you know, a known stimulant and we drank it in moderation, it's probably no big deal. The problem is that it's coffee plus our phones, plus our laptops, plus food, which has been drugified, plus our entertainment, which is now accessible 24/7. So that, you know, ultimately what's happening is that we're escaping reality, right? Where we're wanting to be more and more in that place where we don't have to be fully present for ourselves and other people in our lives. And it's our natural instinct to do that.
Yeah.
You know, which is, makes it really, really a hard project, and also a collective project, because if we're on our own trying to, you know, get back to homeostasis and normal, healthy dopamine levels, and no one else is coming with us, well, it's a pretty lonely place. You know, I think often now of parents saying, well, I'd be more than happy to send my kid out to the back alley to play kick the can, but there are no other kids there because right. they're all inside on their computers. And that's absolutely right. It's a collective problem. And that's why I think, you know, this conversation is so important. When I say this conversation, I mean, this societal problem right. is really where we have to essentially, you know, begin to build a world within a world where we insulate ourselves from not just our drug of choice, but also the constant triggers that also release dopamine that make us crave our drug of choice.
Mm-hmm. You talked about self-binding in the book. So basically, when we are in this constant exposure, if we go to the point where we recognize that whatever our drug of choice is, be it cocaine or romance novels, is impeding with our lives, and we want to change our relationship to that thing, first of all, it has to be conscious, but there's this tool that you're talking about called self-binding that goes along with it. I'm going to bring it back to the collective you were just talking about, but first, can you tell us about self-binding?
Sure. Yeah. So self-binding is a way to use both literal and metacognitive barriers between ourselves and our drug of choice so that we can press the pause button between desire and consumption. Of course, you know, willpower, we have it. But it's not an unlimited resource. We wake up with more willpower in the morning than we have at the end of the day when we're tired. It renews itself typically over 24 hours. But if we just rely on our willpower and continue to allow ourselves to be constantly triggered, we're not going to make progress. And it's very, very difficult, you know, once we have that pleasure-pain balance tipped to the side of pain, to resist the cravings and the general despair of that a neurophysiologic state. So much better that we don't get into it at all. And we can do that by, again, creating these barriers. So for example, for my romance novel addiction, one of the big instigators was when I got an e-reader. I got a Kindle, which made it possible for essentially me to be a chain reader. As soon as I finished one book, I could go on and read the next. I got, you know, cheaper and cheaper samples on Amazon. You can get free romance novels. I needed more potency over time to get the same effect. I ended up, you know, reading frank erotica that was not consistent with my values. It was interfering with my ability to be the parent and the spouse and the psychiatrist that I want to be. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things I did when I realized I had to abstain for 30 days, which is what I recommend to patients in order to reset reward pathways, I got rid of the Kindle. I got rid of my, I just simply threw it away. Mm-hmm. And that was a self-binding strategy. Now, if I wanted to romance, I had to go to the library or I had to go to a bookstore. It's not a big barrier, but it's just enough that it allows me access whatever remaining willpower I may have and remember why it is that I didn't want to read romance novels in that month of abstinence. So, that's an example. You know, it's a literal geographic barrier. Other geographic barriers are things, again, like putting our phones in a different room, turning off our phones or devices, deleting certain apps. Other barriers for like addicted gamblers, they can put themselves on a no playlist. So if they go to the casino, they can't actually get in because they're on a list like that. Other things might be categorical self-binding strategies where I realize, okay, well, I can read maybe a certain type of, like for a while, I felt I could read certain inspirational romance novels. That's a genre of romance novels that they're quite religious and they have very little sex in them. Mm-hmm. But I told myself I could read those, but not other types of romance novels. So that's a categorical strategy, right? Well, I can, and food, we do this a lot. Okay, I can, obviously I'm going to eat food because unless, you got to eat, but I'm not going to have cookies or I'm not going to have processed food or I'm not going to have, you know, why? Because that's my drug of choice. Once I start, I can't stop. Or maybe it's even just like a trigger. So one of the things that I noticed in my effort to abstain from romance was that certain kinds of romantic songs on the radio, you know, which most pop music is, that would then trigger craving for me. So then I stopped listening to that music, you know, as a way to achieve my goal. So that's the thinking on self-finding.
Yeah. So I was thinking about this in the context of, you know, your book is Dopamine Nation. I think you're speaking a lot to just our US audience, people who are, we do have an abundance of stimulation in this country, just a fact. And a lot of the things that are really ridiculously addictive have come from us, like yes. social media and processed foods and all of these things, like we right. created them. I'm going to say that word binding was reminding me of just the thought of like containers and structure and framework.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm thinking about how we had more of these in previous eras, and we have fewer and fewer formal yeah. structures to our life. So mm-hmm. we have, you know, fewer people are going to any sort of religious institution. Our family structures look really different. Our school structure can look really different. And then of course, over the pandemic, it was almost like any structure we had remaining was completely gone and people are going to work in their pajamas because
right.
right. video,
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And so the structures that used to exist aren't there for us. So we have yeah. to then create them ourselves. Is yes. that really part of the underpinning of the self-binding, is that we don't have those structures to rely on anymore?
Yeah, that's really well said, because you're absolutely right. You know, all humans need structure, but I can tell you my patients struggling with addiction, structure is a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. And they do much, much better with structure. I do better with structure. And you're right, our society and our home life, it's all gotten looser and looser and looser. You know, even the sort of sacred family dinner is now gone by the wayside, because many kids have their kids in
activities.
Sports. Yeah, that are occurring. You know, so, you know, you could do a family dinner, but only half your family can show up at any, you know, given time. There's no consensus time. So it's really tough. Really a hard time to be a parent for all those reasons. But I think anything that we can do as parents, especially when our kids are little and we do have more, let's say, executive control over what's happening with them and in the home, really important to have regular meal times, regular bedtimes, regular wake times, to have, you know, if not a day of Sabbath, at least a distinction from the work week when the family does different collective things together. I mean, what's so amazing is that, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, many families not only spent their leisure time together, they also worked together. They worked in the mm-hmm. home making textiles. They worked in the farms. Now, not only are we all flying out in different directions to work and go to school, but also, of course, our leisure time is separate. No longer are we even watching the same movie at the same time. We're all on our devices in different rooms watching different things. So I think just acknowledging this and acknowledging that it has really eroded mm-hmm. the family, you know, in many ways, and then just being really intentional about trying to bring that back in and creating a consistent structure. I remember my now 19-year-old son, who's a sophomore in college now, but one day he came home when he was about 5, and it was 5 o'clock, and that was when we always had dinner in those days, and the kids mm-hmm. were little and we could make that happen. And for whatever reason, that day I hadn't set the table and I didn't have dinner, and he came in and he had a literal meltdown. He's like, "Where's dinner? We always have dinner at 5, right? What's going on?" Yeah. And it was just such a great reminder to me how much kids need structure, key into structure, how important it is for them to, you know, to feel safe, and not just kids, us too, mm-hmm. which means that, you know, it doesn't mean you want to be like rigid about everything. You know, I had to explain to him, well, you know, some days, you know, it doesn't work out. Right.
Yeah.
And some days, you know, then you got to learn to tolerate that too. But in general, really, really important for there to be some kind of consensus structure. Mm-hmm. And it will change over time as kids age, right? So what kids need in terms of the household structure when they're 5 is going to be different than what they need when they're 15. Mm-hmm. So being flexible and appreciating that, okay, well, we used to do that, it was great, but now we need to do it slightly differently because, you know, the circumstances have changed, but still having a structure
around it. Yeah. Yeah. My intention was to follow up with a question around things like Alcoholics Anonymous, which I do want to ask you about, but this direction of this conversation reminded me of a book I recently read called The Art of Gathering. I believe the author is Priya Parker, but the entire book is about the necessity of a structure for any sort of gathering. So like, even if it's a party, right? Yeah. Like mm-hmm. people want to know why they're there and they want to know how to act.
Yes.
So if it's a costume party, people are happier if you tell them it's an 80s costume party. And you also should be an 80s rock star.
Right.
And then people can actually just like feel calmer because they know what's their coming.
Yeah, they know what their role is. No, it's really true. I mean, sometimes patients will say, well, I don't, you know, when they're in for seeing me for psychotherapy or, you know, treatment, like, well, I don't really understand how this works. And I said, yeah, there's no reason that you should understand it. But one of the reasons it does work is because there's a very defined structure. I have a role. You have a role, right? We are here to talk about you and your problems, not me and my problems, right? What we talk about in here stays in here. It's a safe space. You know, you'll talk, I'll listen, I'll respond based on what you've said. That makes people feel so much safer. I'll have people with terrible, terrible social anxiety who can't go to any parties or converse with people in public, but who have no trouble talking at length, you know, in this setting. Why? Because the roles are defined.
Finding
ways to help people with that and to define the structure and to give them roles is really, really helpful.
I wonder if that's why people are seeking more distraction, is the feeling of unease of not having a role to play. Or like in a tribe, like these are the hunters and these are the loom weavers and these are the cookers or whatever it is.
We're
supposed to define these roles for ourselves. And a lot of people have a lot of trouble defining those roles for themselves, but.
Yeah. So I think there is a sense that sort of life is so uncertain and kind of spinning out of control. And that's what makes the devices so compelling, right? Because in that space, we have complete control. We can swipe right. We can swipe left. We can,
like it.
You know, delete it. We can start over again and get a new avatar. And, you know, it's all completely within our control. And yet paradoxically, you know, at the same time, we're seeking kind of to lose ourselves. So we want to be, I think in many ways, subject to something greater than ourselves. And yet in pursuit of that, what we do is try to seek more and more control over our escaping from ourselves. So it's a really fascinating paradox.
Yeah. So thinking about how we get ourselves out of this box, or maybe we're not going to get out of the box because no one's going to turn off social media or unmake the Lay's potato chips of no one eat just one, right? Like right. We are going to be exposed to those things. So first step for someone would be recognizing if they want to change. And then if they do, probably why? And then the structures are sometimes self-imposed, sometimes things that are like community groups. Mm-hmm. What are things that people can do when they want to start to make a shift in how they're kind of on autopilot with the dopamine?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I recommend is to think of a substance or behavior that we ingest that we wish we used less of or not at all or in a different way. And then conceptualize that as our drug of choice, whether it's romance novels or online chess or cupcakes or alcohol, whatever it is. And then the first thing is to fast from that drug or behavior for 30 days. Why 30 days? Because that's the average amount of time it takes for those neuroadaptation gremlins to hop off the pain side of the balance and for homeostasis or a level balance to be restored. And it's really important to restore that level balance. Number one, to just feel better and recapture our ability to take joy in more modest rewards, but also to get insight into how our drug use, and I use the term drug broadly, is impacting our lives. Because when we're in it, we really can't see it. And that's just something that I've seen again and again in myself, in my patients. I always warn people that they're going to feel worse before they feel better when they give up their drug of choice. But if you can just hang in there for about 2 to 3 weeks, that's usually the critical turning point where then in weeks 3 and 4, people start to really feel a lot better, not just better than they did in the first 2 weeks when they were in withdrawal, but actually better than they have in a long time. So holding that carrot out as sort of the motivation, you know, that you can actually feel a lot better and be happier. If you can just do without your pleasure for a period of time. And then once we get to those 4 weeks and we feel better, because most everybody does feel better by doing that, then be really thoughtful. Okay, do I want to continue to abstain? Is it possible for me to continue abstain? If so, or even if not, how am I going to reintegrate this substance or behavior back into my life. And patients will always say that they, well, not always, but they'll mostly say they want to go back to using, but they want to use differently.
Yeah.
They want to use less. They want to use, and they want to be more, you know, have more autonomy and control over how mm-hmm. they're using it. And that's where self-binding comes in. You know, that's where we make these, we put these barriers in place, and then we try to either use in moderation or continue to abstain, and we see how that goes. And if it doesn't go well, then we have to rethink our self-binding strategies, or we have to rethink maybe moderation isn't possible for me when it comes to this drug. Mm-hmm. Maybe I really need to abstain from the long haul.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the strategy. Doing it collectively as a family or with friends mm-hmm. is a really good idea. You know, setting it together, and then you have that support. And again, importantly, knowing that you'll feel worse before you feel better, but if you just get to 2 weeks, you'll really notice a big improvement.
Start to change. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I always do a dry January. I've heard people do Sobertober, which I think is October. But I think there is the power of the collective in those, in those moments. So like, it's not a problem because everybody is all doing this one thing together, and it feels more comfortable. So you're not the one person doing the weird thing outside of everybody
else.
Kind
of normalizes it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those types of fasts, I mean, almost every major religious tradition has something like that. So even before neuroscience confirmed it to be the case, people have instinctively known that a dopamine fast from, you know, some kind of reinforcing substance is really important for resetting brain pathways. I think what we're only just realizing now is that we can get addicted to behaviors as well, including digital drugs. And so abstinence from those behaviors is really important to reset reward pathways.
Mm-hmm. I did a digital detox at the end of the year last year, where I just said, and it was actually like this interesting thing for me was there is an aspect kind of like this, kind of like when people do some sort of food change, like you still have to eat, right?
Right.
With my phone, I was like, okay, my phone, but if I want to get together with someone in person, I actually still have to use the phone to call them.
Right. Yeah,
or like if I need directions to somewhere that I'm meeting someone, like I'm going to pull up my Google Maps. I don't have a map in my car.
Right. Or ride share you know, there are many things that, So then it's a matter of deleting the apps that you don't want to use. Being really intentional. Sometimes I recommend writing down what you're going to do on the phone or the device before you actually go on it. That can
so
be
you don't
a way to
forget. Yeah.
Right. Create that intentionality, things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I have been noticing lately how often I go to do something in particular, and then I get connected on whatever thing was the last thing I had up on my phone. Doesn't even matter what it was.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, what was I here for? Like, why did I even open this device?
Yeah. Yeah.
Designed to capture attention.
Yes. So how did your digital detox go?
So I think the first thing, it was kind of like what you described in the book, like you just start to notice your own response, you know, your own thing. I mean, I probably should have kept track of how many times I just like reached for my phone with no, like there was no reason to, like it was just a knee jerk reaction. Mm-hmm. I kept reaching for it to just like, get my mind off whatever. I was bored sitting at a restaurant for 10 minutes for a table. Like, let me go play a game on my phone. So like so much realizing how many times that I was mindlessly reaching for it.
Right.
And then for sure there was almost like that painful, like, well, what am I supposed to do now? Like, okay, I got to fill this up with something.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really did feel like something was leaving my, like I had been possessed my body.
Yeah,
and I was kind of sad. Like, I mean, it wasn't quite 2 weeks, but like around that 2 week mark is when I was like, okay, well, I got like lots of things have to happen again in my life. Right. Cause you know, end of the year, I was able to, holidays, the people weren't online anyway.
Right.
But it was a different experience when I came back, and I was definitely much more aware and methodical. Mm-hmm. But now, 9 months later, I'm probably back to where I was. So like, I'm really looking forward to the digital detox again this December.
Exactly.
That's going
to
be amazing.
Yeah, I think that's true to life with these devices and these digital drugs. It's more normal than not to gradually slip over time, but at least we're slipping now with the awareness of what's happening, why it's happening. And the importance of, you know, resetting reward pathways, of doing the dopamine fast again and kind of resetting those pathways, you know, at some kind of pulsed interval that's right for us in our lives, in order to kind of just remind ourselves and have a healthier relationship with these devices. It's not that we're, you know, the genie is not going back into the bottle, you know, but we've got to figure out how to have healthier relationships with this technology.
Yeah. I appreciated how much you went to the gray zone there. Like, I feel like that's the sticky place of most conversations. Like, people can usually agree on the outer edges of something where nobody's going, but where the line is of what's okay and what's not okay and what's too much. And that's the sticky part, I think, personally, and in these larger conversations. I don't know if we have time to fully go into this conversation. I'll ask for a quick bit of opinion here. But I live in Colorado, and on the ballot in a few weeks is psilocybin.
You're right.
Mm-hmm. And we were the first state to legalize marijuana a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And there is this growing interest in microdosing, mm-hmm. which I think is people's attempt to find a smaller spot. Like, oh, I'm not going to go do a weekend of mushrooms. But mm-hmm. like, I mean, I was researching it recently. And I was seeing that there was like this whole like group here. It's called like Moms Who Microdose. Like, it's mm-hmm. a social group. Mm-hmm. And I was like, mm-hmm. this is fascinating. So mm-hmm. maybe your thoughts, if you have them, quickly on like microdosing.
Yeah. So, you know, psilocybin, you know, these are psychedelics. They release an enormous amount of serotonin in the brain and also dopamine. They are addictive, contrary to what you will read in, you know, the general lay press, or even what some scientists will say. These are absolutely mm-hmm. addictive. People get addicted to them. They use them repeatedly in harmful ways.
Yeah.
The science is really at the very beginnings. So there's not currently robust evidence that they are effective treatment for any psychiatric disorder. There's some mm. preliminary evidence suggesting that in certain contexts they may be helpful, but I can tell you it's not really robust. So if you one head-to-head study published in the New England Journal comparing psilocybin with an SSRI, which is an antidepressant approved by the FDA for the treatment of depression, basically psilocybin was no better, but psilocybin has many more serious adverse events, including, you know, persistent perceptual disturbances. So, you know, like the melting walls thing, people
that
can
sound scary
the rest of their lives, right?
Yeah, wow.
People can get psychotic when they take these, you know, molecules. So although, you know, I've talked to people who said that it was transformative in a positive way. You know, I hear that, and I'm trying to remain open, but I also think it's really important that the media and the online chatter doesn't get ahead of the evidence, because that happens so often mm-hmm. and people are harmed as a result. So
yeah,
I would just say the evidence isn't there yet. Mm-hmm. We know about real harms. It is addictive. It is pressing hard and fast on the pleasure side of the balance, which means come downs are real. Yeah. Blue Monday is a real thing. And also there are other, you know, potentially permanent mind altering effects, even with very limited exposure. So I'm not sure it's worth that, you know,
right.
The other thing too, is, you know, people talk about wanting a spiritual awakening. You know, I would think that there are other ways to get that spiritual awakening, that, yeah, take longer, but probably mm-hmm. lead to more lasting and more permanent brain changes, because you had to work for them over a long period of time.
Yeah. Well, and there is this whole area of study of these kind of endogenously produced feel-good chemicals of a variety of sorts, right? But that we actually have the capacity for our own bodies to create these things in the right circumstances. You were mentioning somebody, you know, a patient who was doing the cold dips in your book.
Right.
That's something I actually practice.
Okay, great. Yeah, the ice cold water showers, yeah. Ice cold water baths. Yeah.
And there is that pain pleasure piece that I know you were talking about, but it is like the, great. I'm my own pharmacy.
Right. And this is the whole science of hormesis. Hormesis is Greek for to set in motion. Mm-hmm. And essentially when we expose our body to mild to moderate noxious stimuli, like exercise, ice cold water, intermittent fasting, or even just challenging psychological and intellectual endeavors, what we're essentially doing is telling our body to upregulate its own healing hormones and neurotransmitters. We're telling our dopamine factories to make more dopamine, mm-hmm. which means that that's very exciting, because it means that we can get that dopamine, we can get that high, but we do it by paying for it up front. And that way we avoid getting into this dopamine deficit state, which is the hallmark of addiction. Of course, in some rare cases, people can get addicted to pain.
Right.
And for example, get addicted to exercise, but it's very rare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that idea, actually, that you just said of like, we're paying for it up front instead of later. Like there is no escaping that you're going to pay for it.
No free lunch.
There's no free lunch.
It's really true.
But you could choose to pay for it up front instead of putting it on layaway.
Yes. So yes, that's right.
Then you're dealing with it, but then your reward.
Yeah.
Is on the other side. And then you don't have those potential addictive, or a much lower chance of those addictive pieces. Awesome.
Yes, exactly.
This has been a great interview, Dr. Lemke. I wish we had more time. I always like to end with my fast four that are just fun questions. So this has nothing to do with your current work. It might, actually.
Yeah.
First one is, and maybe this is my personal dopamine thing, I love music. I love live music. Uh-huh. So I always ask what your first concert was, if you remember.
Wow. I think my first concert, I'm trying to remember. I'm blanking on her name. I love folk music, and she's like an acoustic folk guitarist. And she was sort of famous for about 5 minutes, and then she disappeared. I can't remember her name, but it would have been a folk music concert.
Awesome. I love that. I love that music too. Do you have a morning routine? And if so, what does it look like?
Yes, I do. I get up early, usually around 5 or 6 in the morning, and I either go for a walk or go for a swim.
Awesome. Cold waters.
You know, I'm not a cold water person. I can't do that. I was in Iceland recently with my family, and they have these alternating ice cold. Yeah. I actually can't do that. That's not me. No.
What's on your nightstand?
Books. I'm a big reader.
Yeah. Me too. No romance novels.
Not anymore. I gave that up. Gave that up for the long haul.
Cool. And last question, any unusual talents or fun things that nobody knows about you?
I don't know, not nobody, but many people don't know that I speak Mandarin Chinese. I lived in China for a while after I graduated college, and I lived there, taught English there, came home, was a bilingual teacher for a while, and still occasionally get to use it in my practice.
I bet all sorts of new neurological pathways were formed. You learning Mandarin.
Yes.
Awesome. Right. Well, I am so glad we got to have this conversation. I will be linking in the show notes to your book, your website, any other places that people can find you. I know you're on social media, so.
Not on social media. Yeah. No, nowhere else. That's it. And I appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, everyone should go buy your book. Thank you so much for this view, and I hope have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for inviting me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Awesome.
Hey, if you've been on the hormonal roller coaster and want to know how to put the theories and strategies shared on this podcast to work for your body, I want to invite you to join me in my program, The Bitch Fix in 6 Steps to Happy Hormones. I'll help you heal your hormones naturally so you can get your mood, energy, and mojo back and live the badass life you were designed for. This is the work I've done with hundreds of women, and it can work for you too. To learn more, go to thebitchfixin6.com. I can't wait to meet you inside.